This podcast represents the opinions of Whiskey Wheels Wounds and guests to the show. The content here is for informational use only and should not be taken as medical advice. Consult your healthcare professional for medical questions. Views and opinions expressed are our own or guests and do not represent any organization we are a member of. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statement or opinion made. This podcast contains explicit language and mature content. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Whiskey, Wheels, and Wounds. I'm Sean Naber, 9-year United States Air Force vet.
And I am Steve Vickers, 22-year U.S. Army veteran.
I'm good.
I'm good.
Let's ride.
Okay, boys, time for the show.
And today we're going to be talking about a subject that affects most veterans, especially ones that have seen combat. I've said before that I think this topic affects you a little more deeply and more prevalent than it does me. And that would be survivor's guilt.
Yeah. And so survivor's guilt is a response to an event in which someone else experienced loss, but you didn't. So, and like we said, you know, in combat, it's very prevalent. Everyone that has served most likely knows someone who perished. You know, you were on a FOB or whatever, and someone on that FOB, you know, yep. What I mean? Especially when it's indirect fire.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Indirect fire. And you're like, wow, that could have been me.
Yep.
And, it's very easy to put yourself, you know, if it was three chews over, or, you know, if, you know, whatever, I mean, that what if thing, that we talk about, Well, you can mind fuck what if forever. So, survivor's guilt is very prevalent, strong response, factor for post-traumatic stress. And, so my survivor's guilt, and I hold guilt, it's one of the emotions I hold, I put the most weight on, if you will. I don't know why. I've talked to several professionals to tell me a why, but,
it's just the way you're wired.
It's, you know, and that's kind of what they think too. I put a lot of, put a lot of pressure on myself. I was a platoon sergeant for 3 deployments in Iraq. So you're in charge of 30 dudes, to include a young platoon leader. And, you put a lot of, pressure on yourself to bring people home. And yeah. especially at a combat engineer, you know, The survival rate for a combat engineer in, you know, World War II or Vietnam is, you know, very short. And, so when I came in the Army, you know, you held that in your head, you know, throwing a grappling hook through a minefield. What's the life expectancy of a grappling man through a minefield during full-scale offensive operations? It's very short, I would think. So with that being said, you know, I was a constant trainer, you know, I mean, I kept, you know, would train this, train something else, train, you know, so, and because I, you know, I can handle a lot of guilt. My inability to train someone properly to survive a firefight was not going to be one. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You know, IEDs don't give a shit. Roadside bombs, they don't give a shit if you're, you know, special forces, Navy SEAL, or just a supply clerk.
Yeah, or you know, like you said, mortars and rockets, IDF, you know, it's just...
Don't care, right? So, you know...
you could be the baddest of the bad sitting on a port-a-john taking a shit and be a mortar round right to the port-a-john.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, so,
like, you got no chance.
Right. So, and you quickly find out that you're being... Your contact with the enemy is more indirect. It's more roadside bombs. It's, you know, very few times was it, you know, mano-a-mano, you know what I mean? So you're like, well, shit. Now what? You know what I mean? Like, now it's a crapshoot. And
they, especially in Iraq after the main invasion, it was more of a guerrilla war, you
right.
know, where yep. they used their cunning and creativeness against our numbers and better firepower.
They did exactly what they had to do.
Yep.
To, you know what I mean? And so I was in a combat engineer company, my second deployment in Iraq. We were in Bakuba. Or Baki Ba for the locals in Iraq hearing this podcast.
I'm sure there's a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure. We were in a police station in the center of the city, walled in. The building was made with walls around it, which made it perfect for us to take over. There was units there before us. But we took over for, a unit from the Big Red One, that was there before us in 04. And, we got in there and, we were a engineer company. So that's, you know, I think about 80 guys in the company. So we were one platoon minus, and we had an infantry platoon and an MP platoon that plussed us up. One platoon, they provided force protection. They had people up on the roofs, crew served weapons, things of that nature, guys down at the gate. We had a walk-in gate that, you know, we took people in, all the time that wanted to be police, you know, they wanted to apply to be police. And then we would, once we'd get enough of them, we'd put them on buses and we'd take them up north in the Al-Samaniya or take them down to, Baghdad, put them on planes and fly them out to Jordan. And that was, you know, kind of my platoon's mission. We did a lot of the escort missions. We also ran to a nearby FOB and we picked up chow since our chow hall was a building with tables in it that everyone, it was a central location people went to eat. We didn't have hot chow. We didn't have stoves or none of that.
But before you get on that, I think people need to understand that it wasn't just you guys that were in this building, this compound. Like there was a lot of local nationals.
Oh yeah. 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 I mean, at any given time, there was 50 to 200 Iraqi nationals, downstairs underneath us. And you know, it was winning hearts and minds, that, you know, the higher ups, you know, they wanted joint operations, joint missions and things of that nature. And,
the plan was to give their country back to them,
right,
and help them take it over,
right. And but you dwindle that down to the squad leader, and you know, you have your privates and your specials, like, what the fuck, like, yeah, like, these are, like, you know, like, it's one of those.
I'm pretty sure that cat was shooting at me last night.
Right. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And he most likely was. And so for the most part, the higher up Iraqi leadership that was in this compound, they were vetted, and they were deemed worthy to, you know, get in a little intel here and there. And I was a staff sergeant, so it was above my pay grade. And I had personally, my feeling at the time, I had zero worry, right? You know, I walked around with one under the chamber magazine in, I was in the, you know, wish a motherfucker would mode, you know what I mean?
Like,
fuck around and find out mode. Like, yeah. So, you know, it was, your weapon was always hot where we, you know what I mean? Like,
so now I got you off topic.
Yeah.
Let me get you back.
Okay.
Mermites, hot chow.
Yeah. Yep. Mermites and hot chow. Appreciate you.
It was my fault. So.
Right. So we would have to go to another FOB and get hot chow. Right. So, it was MREs for lunch, and hot chow for dinner, you know? And, so that was how we lived for a year. And, In August of 2005, day started out like any other day. Went out and got chow, came back, brought it back. And I would go eat at the end of the chow hours, right? You know, being a big dude, I like to eat. So it just seemed like, you know, the best scenario for me. And I had a lieutenant in the first platoon who, same way, you know, I mean, he was on that workout thing and trying to get big, and he needed some substance. And so we would meet up right there in the gym every day. We were both back at the compound, and, you know, we'd meet up at the gym and then we'd go down and eat. On this particular day, as we were walking by the shitter, I said, you know, go ahead, LT, I'll meet you down there. I'm going in here and have a sit down. And, so I did. And
I'm going to stop you for a second. There was another reason why you and the LT ate at the end of chow as well. Because of the population that was in the chow hall.
Right.
Yeah. To set the scene.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But appreciate you. Yeah. So some of those higher ups, the vetted ones, they were allowed to come into the chow hall and eat chow at the end. And basically, you know, my thought was, again, I don't give a shit. You know what I mean? I'll eat with them. And if something pops off, you know, I don't have to run far, because you know what I mean?
And your guys are out already, so you're not worried about them.
Right, right. So, yeah, all my guys ate, you know, everybody in the company already ate, you know, most of the time. It's just me and a lieutenant and depending on where the first sergeant was and what he was doing, he'd come down and eat last, like, you know, like a good leader does, him and the commander. So it was bare bones. You know what I mean? Like, they gave them a 30-minute window at the end of Chow, right? So,
and that's how Chow was for almost a year.
For a year. And so, you know, throughout the year, the threat level, they didn't do that. They didn't eat there all year. You know, we had to build some trust with them. We had to build some rapport or whatever. And so we put, you know, we put measures in place. Like, we put, you know, barriers outside where, you know, these Iraqi police officers would have to come in and check. We check their credentials, look at the list. Are they allowed? Yes, yes. Boom. All right. All that was in place. So, I mean, we took preventive measures so that somebody wouldn't walk in with a suicide vest and or whatever, right? So, I mean, we mitigated as many risks as one can.
You right? can't eliminate risks in a war zone, but you can mitigate them.
Right, you can mitigate them, right? So, so we did that, right? So, LT goes downstairs. I'm dispensing last night's class one to upload tonight's class one, and in the midst of taking a shit, I hear the explosion. Right. So, but the explosion wasn't. We did command debts. We had a pit inside our compound where if we found something on the road, if we whatever. We use our explosives and we do command debts. And so the explosion wasn't, oh my God, immediately, but usually prior to a command debt, it goes over the radio. We're having a command debt in, you know, 10 minutes. And then they do a countdown. Again, we're mitigating, right? So, you know, the initial thought wasn't, holy shit, we're under attack. It was, huh. And then the radio goes fucking nuts with, you know, people trying to figure out what the fuck, you know, people on the roof. The chow hall just exploded. And you're like, what the fuck? You know, like, there's nothing in there. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing in there to explode. What the fuck? So immediately run downstairs. Come out the bottom door. And so our building was adjacent to where the chow hall was. Chow hall was in a lower, like a one floor. We were in a two floor building. The chow hall and these other offices was in a one floor adjacent building. And so immediately in front of the door I'm coming out of is one of the Iraqi assistant chiefs, you know, one of the higher up guys. He had an office immediately across from the entry to the building. And his door was open and I could see part of the wall that separated his office and the chow hall was in his office. And So through that door I go and over the rubble into the chow hall. And now I'm just looking for Lieutenant, right? Lieutenant Diaz. And I do a sweep. You can hear yelling. There was some MPs that were in there. There was a couple special forces guys that were in there. Iraqis that were in there. So, you know, there was a handful, I would say maybe 8 or 9 people at the most in there when this happened. And, in the middle of the floor by the entry door, again, I didn't come through the entry door. I came through a wall that was blown down. Was a man laying on the ground, clothed. He was naked. dark skinned guy, very soiled, you know, some burn marks, things of that nature. And, so again, didn't pay no mind as I'm going through. I'm just looking for lieutenant, you know.
You're looking for the LT, and in your mind, that was the perpetrator of the attack.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't like you were just like, I don't give a shit. It was, he's clearly, to me, the perpetrator. I need to go find to make sure that everyone's accounted for and safe.
Right. And so I get to the far end of our chow hall room. Right. Was the mechanic chief's office. Right. So the shop for our maintenance team, and that wall was also down. So it was each wall was blown into the offices away from the chow hall. So that's the, we'll call that the north and south end of the chow hall. Those walls were blown out. The east and west sides of the chow hall where the door was and then the back wall, they were bowed, right? This is Iraqi construction, you know what I mean? So it's not, you know, there's no rebar, there's no, but it's bowed out.
It's not Afghani mud hut, but it's also not Western concrete construction.
Right. It's level two fucking, Middle East bullshit. So as you're going, and it's like, I don't know, 5-6 o'clock in the evening. I mean, there's still light outside, but you know what I mean? So you're going through. And oh, by the way, like a dude just clapped off a vest in there. So you have smoke, you know, there's still residuals all over the place. You're walking into a whole bunch of shit that, you know, so the fog of war, if you will.
Yeah. Dust, debris, you know, some body components.
Right. Right.
The ringing of the ears, the loud explosion,
right,
you know, stuff that people deal with. And
now a word from our sponsor, Ohio Cigar Mafia. Are you in the state of Ohio and a cigar enthusiast? Join the ranks of over 200 members who enjoy a good stick paired with a sip of their favorite spirit as they raise money for veterans. Ohio Cigar Mafia is a 501c3 who supports the Southeastern Guide Dogs. They allow veterans to witness a brighter future through the eyes of a service dog. Thank you, Ohio Cigar Mafia, for your support. So as I make my way, so I get to the end where the maintenance chief office is, and I don't see nobody in there. I mean, the wall fell like intact, pretty much, opposed to the other wall where the Iraqi police chief, assistant police chief was. It was, you know, it came in pieces, chunks, big chunks, but pieces nonetheless. So as I came back through, one of the MP E5, Sergeant Leitner, she's talking really loud, perforated her eardrums, which is to be expected. You know, that amount of explosives go off in a very narrow corridor, if you will, because it was a long, it was probably, I don't know, maybe 10 feet wide by 50 feet long. So it was a long corridor, you know? And so when explosions go off, it bounces off walls. And when it comes back, when it leaves the origin at a strength and it bounces off something, it comes back at double the strength. And then it bounces again and it keeps reverberating. And that's where the shock wave, if you will, comes from. So, So her eardrums are perforated. She's screaming loudly. And so scoop her up, take her out. By this time, they're you know, we had code words that we would say over over our closed net that the severity of attack on the building, right? Like, and so that all transpired. So everybody's in place, right? So by this time, there's people coming in the chow hall. When I get back, there's someone kneeling over the naked body, and they look at me and said, "This is Lieutenant Diaz." I'm like, "What the fuck?" You know what I mean? And so, you know, we immediately started rendering aid. You know, we got him up, picked him up, took him outside and started rendering aid. We had medics right outside, came back in. We had an American contractor, retired police officer from the States, came to Iraq to help train Iraqi police, you know, doing his part for the war cause, and named Mike Dawes. And he also was hit, and but he, you know, he's one of them. He was one of those old cats that said, "I'm fine. I'm good. Can you walk?" "Yeah, I can walk." And he kind of limped out. And he sat by the medic's truck, and you know, it's like you go back in, and then you realize the motor sergeant is trapped under the wall that fell in his off. We had a motor sergeant, and then one of his sergeants were trapped under a wall, and you know, one was sitting in a rolling chair. So when the blast happened, the wall came, the chair kind of helped him. Another one was sitting in a folding chair, and that chair didn't help him as much. And the wall came down on him, and as he, you know, you have no way to react if you don't know it's coming. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So when the wall, like, if you're sitting, if I'm, you know, just picture yourself sitting against a brick wall and in a folding chair, right, that has zero give. And that wall just falls on you, right? Like, you're going to fold like wherever that weight is taking you.
Yep.
And that's what happened. And he had some hip issues and things of that nature. And, he retired, medically retired out because of that injury.
I was going to say, and for individuals that don't, like, you're hearing Steve say he went into the room and he didn't see anybody. Then he went and did this. And then he found out later there was someone under the wall. There's so much chaos. You do an initial sweep.
Right.
And then after you do the initial sweep, then you start, you know, things kind of, I don't want to say calm down, but they kind of like become more controlled. And then you're doing accountability and trying to find everybody. And then you're doing a more thorough sweep. So it's easy to miss someone who's underneath a wall that you can't visually see in the initial sweep, but during a more thorough sweep, you figure out, hey, these guys were in their office. We need to go and look. And then you start pulling the wall back and you're finding things. So it's not like Steve walked through the office, had his eyes closed and didn't see that they were under the wall. There's just a lot that goes into those initial sweeps. And then there's more thorough sweeps.
Right. And yeah. And, so then, you know, once we clear everybody out, you again, there was eight to 10 bodies individuals, 8 to 10 individuals in the chow hall. The assistant chief, he died. Wall crushed him. But then, you know, you go outside and again, you're checking over, you know, it's one of those things where the medic's doing his job. We're trying to get a bird to come in and land at our FLA and it was just hard to get a bird in and hard to get, you know, so they ended up, putting him in the, FLA and driving him, up to, that, you know, our main FOB. And he, succumbed to his wounds, as did Mike Doss. Mike Doss had a very small wound on his right, on his carotid, in his thigh. And, you know, they put a tourniquet on and he died. He died of his wounds as well. And, you know, you, when everything settles, you know, take him away and Lieutenant Diaz was responsive. You know, when you yelled at him, you know, hey, keep your eyes open, LT, and you know, the things that medics are doing, what the medics do, and but they needed more than medics. They needed surgeons. They needed, when you're on a clock like that, it's hard to.
He was already at a disadvantage.
Right.
So minutes mattered.
Yes. Minutes. Minutes mattered. And it's a 15 minute, you know, going as fast as a Humvee can go, without, you know, and that's if you don't get hit with an IED between here and there, you know what I mean? That's why we wanted to bring a bird in. They had more experienced medics on the bird. All those things, it just made sense to bring a bird in, and logistically, you know, for whatever reason, I don't know. The bird couldn't land, and so we had to take him out by ground, and both of them died. It's one of those things where, you know, initially I'm like, well, fuck, man, we're all conditioned, right? At some form of fashion, when we were in basic training, you know, you're bayoneting the dummy, it's kill, and bright red blood. And so at some point you're conditioned, you know, you're like, well, if I have to give my life for my country, man, what a great honor and things of that nature. But then you're in it. And then you're in it, you're like, well, fuck, man. Like, I'm okay with dying for my country, but not today. Like, this motherfucker's going to die for his country today, not me. And, you know, that was my mindset. You know, that's all well and good when you're back home and it's like, yeah, I'm willing to die for my country. And then you get in Iraq and you're like, man, fuck these. You know what I mean? No.
What was it? Was Patton said, nobody ever won a war by dying for their country.
Right. It's
they made the other motherfucker die for his.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing, of course.
Right. But yeah, I mean, it's a great concept until someone dies and you're like, fuck. And, you know, it makes you reevaluate quick, fast, in a hurry. Like how you talk to people around you. You know what I mean? Like how you interact and yeah, I mean it's you know, so the guilt, I guess we'll go into the guilt.
Yeah, let's talk about how you immediately felt after you found out that the LT, you know, he's been injured in this blast. He had to be taken away, ended up succumbing to his injuries.
Right.
So now the dust has settled. Sergeant Steve Vickers is sitting on his rack. It's that night. What's going through your head?
How, you know, I should have been there. First and foremost, should have been there. You know, you're like, this guy's a sapper. He well-trained, smart guy. You know, I give lieutenants a lot of shit, and I've had a lot of good lieutenants. You know what I mean? And Lieutenant Diaz wasn't my lieutenant, but again, we had a good rapport.
But he was still a good lieutenant.
He was still a good lieutenant. Yeah. And at the time in that company, we had several good lieutenants. I mean, it's so in my mind, I'm like, I should have been in there. If I'm in there, so. Let me back up. Knowing explosives like I do, you know, my whole adult life, I've handled, studied, master breachers course, the whole nine. So I understand what explosives do, how they, you know, what response you want to obtain when you use explosives. And through those trainings, you hear that, you know, explosives can blow your clothes off. Right. And you're like, you can't see it in training. Right. So you're like, I'm like, man, I missed that. You know what I mean? Like I missed that. And, so knowing Lieutenant Diaz is the only person without clothes on in the whole building, I know how close proximity he was to the blast. So that makes you think, well, shit, he might have knew something. He might have seen something. He, you know what I mean? And he might have tried to, you know, again, on the other hand, he might not have seen shit. He might have just walked in the door right before this died. You know what I mean? Like, yep. I don't know. But he was in, what I do know for a fact is he was in close proximity to the bomber when he came in.
Yeah.
And so thinking the absolute best of my friend, I think, well, fuck, he might have seen something. And if he saw something, then I probably could have saw something. Or he could have tipped me off, and me and him could have, you know, it's one, it's a superiority, you know, and I clearly identify, you know, it's me thinking I can change the world. I can stop time, and I get that, right?
You know, well, in your head, it's if the LT saw it and I saw it, maybe we could stop him before it pops off.
Right.
Or, you know, in your head, you're thinking if something happens, maybe I was in a position that I could have done something to prevent the severity of the injuries to the LT, you know? Like, you know, it in your head, you're doing all those, like you said, mind fuck what ifs.
Right.
You know, could I have done this? Could I have done that? Would I have done this? Would have? And so, I mean, it's human nature to do that. But unfortunately, you had to see the result so vividly and graphic,
right,
of a result for something that you're going to what if the rest of your life.
Yeah, and to go back to what you were saying, you know, young guy, married, had his whole career ahead of him, you know what I mean? You know, how he was received back home in Puerto Rico with his family and the community, and amazing to see. You know, we saw pictures of his funeral back home. We all sent letters to his wife, and I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those things where events happened since that day. And I wish I was in that jail. You know, I wish, you know, I was standing in close proximity of, you know what I mean, of that guy.
And I think that transitions to where I struggle with survivor's guilt and the fact that I wasn't in any of those types of scenarios. You know, we had IDF, indirect right. fire, you know, but for me, when I'm in my darkest spots, my lowest points, what have you, you know, when I think that my life isn't worth living,
right?
I think about the guys like a Lieutenant Diaz.
Uh-huh.
How much better would the world be if he was here and I wasn't?
Right.
You know, like, and so that's where I struggle with it. It's along the lines of like, and it may be, I don't know, me trying to, somebody will probably say I'm trying to insert myself into a scenario or whatever, but it's not that. It's just that sometimes I feel, you know, especially when I'm in that shit spot, that my life, you know, especially when I was thinking of suicide and stuff, it's not worth living. But we both know cats that died, mm-hmm. that their life would have been so much more worth living. You know, they like, you just know guys that are a better human being than you, and they should have continued on being a better human being, and that it would have been okay with you if it was you that was gone and not them.
Yeah.
And, yep. And so that's where I don't have the what's the word I'm looking for? The close proximity of an event like
right.
you do.
Right.
But the overall understanding yeah. of what guys sacrificed, you yeah. know, I think you call it the, something with, Private Ryan.
Yeah. Yep. The James Ryan effect.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, man, it's one of those things where, I guess you want to feel bad. You want to feel bad. You think you deserve, you have to feel bad, right? Like, not necessarily I want to feel bad, but yep. I need to feel bad. And for a long time I did. I needed to feel bad.
How can you be happy you lived when you feel like you're happy that they're the ones that died and not you? Like it's like a conflicted feeling, you know?
Oh, a conundrum for yeah. sure. I mean, but you know, but some of the coping mechanisms, you know, for dealing with survivor's guilt. Now, one thing you have to understand with, as this podcast goes on and the things we talk about and the things we're, you know, we're not the worst thing you can say to someone is get over it. You yeah. know what I mean? Well, fuck man. If it was that easy, well, okay. Oh, that's all I had to do. Get over it. What? Well, fuck.
Yeah, all right. You're not getting over it because you want to keep that VA rating. You know what I mean?
Right. Absolutely. Right. Like, oh, well, fuck. Why didn't I think of that? Get over it. I mean, and that's, I think, you know, when you talk to civilians and you talk to people that don't understand your experiences, right? That's what turns veterans off, because they use things like that, very broad strokes. Get over it. I'll just think different thoughts. Well, fuck. All right. You know what I mean? Like, that's pretty simple. Think different thoughts. Wow. I mean, instead of thinking this, reform the thought and think of it this way. I'm like, bro, like my brain, I try to turn my brain off so I can sleep on Tuesday. On Thursday, I'm still trying to turn that motherfucker off so I can sleep, right? So yeah. If I could turn it off, I would have did it Tuesday and save myself 48 hours or 72 hours of not sleeping. And so it's not, you know.
It's not a conscious choice.
Right. And people are out there looking for fixes, right? Fix my brain. Fix this. Fix. It's not a fix, man. It's dealing with your new normal differently.
Yep.
Right. And does that take different approaches? Yes. Does it take a different mindset? Yes. I'm not saying that. However, the brain is still fucked up, right? The wires are fucking untangled, right? And so to tell someone, hey, get over it. Yeah, right. But you have to live. You have to live with your new normal, right? So,
yeah. And sometimes they want to, when they say get over it. Okay, some people are ignorant and they say get over it, and they really want you to just get over it. And then, like, when you're talking to VA docs, especially ones that have never seen combat or even enlisted, you know, and been in, when they tell you, they don't say the words get over it, but when they're telling you things like reform the thought and stuff right. like that,
yep.
they're trying to use the literature to help you do that, cope with your new normal and learn to exist with the way your brain is working. It just sometimes you can't, no matter how hard you try, you know, right. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to reform this thought and I'm going to reform this thought. And like you said, 48 hours later, you're still telling yourself, I'm going to reform this thought. And your brain's still saying, nah, fam, fuck you. You're not
right,
sleeping.
Right. And I'm going through it right now. And here we are, you know, we're almost 20 years removed from this event, right? We're at, what, 18 now,
yeah.
right? In August, it'll be 18 years from this event. And I'm unpacking this event with my healthcare professionals now. And it's, you know, here, this is the trigger. This is the response to that trigger, being it mental thoughts and physical, what your body's doing. I'm tensing up, you know, I'm getting clammy, I'm sweating or whatever the case may be. And then the consequences to that thought, to the trigger, to the, you know what I mean? And, you know, one of my questions last week was, hey man, like I woke up and I was in a very depressed mood. And, you know, we had these things coming up and I didn't want to ruin everybody's time. So I just played along like, nothing's wrong, but you know, this book is telling me about triggers and I don't recall a trigger. So how am I supposed to feel about a trigger when I don't recall? Well, sometimes, you know, and then he gives me the doctors that sometimes there won't be. And like, then why the fuck are we talking about? You know what I mean? Like, goddamn, bro.
We look at it from a, I'm living in this,
right?
And they're looking at it from a, practitioner's perspective.
Right.
And sometimes those two perspectives don't line up.
Right. And a lot of the time, they give you things for your tool bag. And here, when you get in this state, use this tool and use that. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. You know what I mean? We started with songs, right? I want you to play a song, close your eyes, and think back to what that song means, right? And good, bad, or ugly. And then think, and then try to change the thought process about this song. And I'm like, but I want to get better.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I want to get better. I want to not ruin my relationship with my wife or the relationship with the child that lives in my house. I don't want to ruin either one of those. So, because I've done that, right? I have a past marriage. I have kids that don't talk to me. I don't want to do that again. And, you know, at some point you have to look and say, well, the common denominator here is me.
Yeah.
Right. So for many years, I was like, I ain't fucked up.
And denial is not just a river in Egypt.
Right. Most certainly. You know, I'm like, you know, and the situation I was in with my ex-wife, it was, you need medication. You need to see a therapist. And I'm like, you just want me on medication. So I'm numb to your bullshit. Right. So I wouldn't do it. Well, now that I'm away from that bullshit, now I'm receptive because I want to be a better person.
Yeah, because the wife now wants you to be better for you.
Right.
Not and, better for her, right. Better for you.
Huge difference.
Yeah, same thing with my wife. She wants me to be better for me because she knows if I'm better for me, then I'm better for everybody else.
Right, exactly.
You know, there's no ulterior motive there. It's genuine care and love.
So coping with survivor's guilt, you know, accept and allow the feelings. Well, that's where my problem, you know, even though survivor's guilt is not always rational. It is recognized response of trauma, right? Yeah. So I tell my therapist all the time, I'm like, in a rational state, you make total fucking sense. I said, but when I'm at fucking level 100 of fucking either pissed off or depressed or anxious or what the combination of all fucking three, four of those, whatever, I'm not rational one fucking bit. So, you know, like, he's like, well, you know, play a song. You know, like, that sounds cool. In practice, not so cool.
Yeah. Like, I tell everybody, you have to buy into therapy. But even when you buy into therapy, sometimes you're like, man, that don't make no motherfucking sense.
Right, right. What else? Connect with others, share feelings and with family and friends. That's what we're doing. It helped both of us, right?
The whole reason this podcast exists.
The whole reason this podcast exists because we reached out to like-minded individuals and we talked unexpectedly and it helped.
Yep.
Right? I'm not in this alone. Oh, shit. You fucking feel that way too? Okay. Yes. And like I've been saying, use mindfulness. I have a whole fucking book upstairs. Use mindfulness techniques. And that is the process of changing your mindset.
Yep.
And you know, it's words on a paper right here. And again, in practice, when you're calm and you're like, wow, that makes total fucking sense. Yeah. And then when you're dealing with survivor's guilt, get that mindful shit out. You know what I mean? Like, let me stew in this. Like, that's what I do a lot. You know what I mean? Like, let me stew in this a little bit because, you know, Carlos ain't here to stew in it. Mike Doss ain't here to stew in what I'm feeling right now. So let me stew in this. practice self-care. I mean, you know, again, the easy thing to do is to check out. The easy thing to do is what? Oh, there's one cure to all this goddamn survivor's guilt shit. You know what I mean? But you can't do that.
Yeah.
You have to change. You have to gain control of your situation. And by letting your mind control you, you have lost control of self. You have lost self-control, right? So, you know, the thoughts are still there. You know what I mean? And
the rational mind needs to be the voice, not the irrational mind.
Right. I mean, the thoughts are still there. And it's how you deal with them now. It's the consequences are not so severe, right? It's how you deal with them. And that's the trick. And the trick is to surround yourself with people who unconditionally love you, right? Unconditionally.
Yep.
And they want nothing but you to be the best version of yourself. And like you said earlier, our wives clearly do that. And our friends clearly do that. And so by doing so, you know, you don't have to understand post-traumatic stress. You don't have to understand, you don't have to understand why I have post-traumatic stress or understand the circumstances that led me to have depression or anxiety or things, irritability or things of that nature. But understand post-traumatic stress. Understand, you know, again, one of the things my ex-wife, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress in 2005, right? Coincidentally, this happened in 2005, you know? So, you know, I got divorced in 2019. So that's many years of her living with someone with post-traumatic stress, and she didn't want to, you know, it was just easy to blame, right? And no matter how many times I said, hey, you know, let's go come to a session with me, come to, you know, this meeting or this appointment or whatever. You know, it was easy to say you're this, that, and the other, right? My current wife is, you know, 180 degree different. And she gives me a lot of rope, right? A lot of, because she loves me, she identifies, she sees it coming before I know it's coming.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So she's like, hey, why don't you go take a ride? You know what I mean? And, you know, she'll tell the daughter to come over and watch the kid and then, hey, go take a ride. You know, because she knows.
Yeah. And she gives you the rope so that she can help pull you back.
Oh, yeah.
Where the ex-wife gave you the rope so she could hang you with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Most definitely. Yeah.
And that's how Brandy is. She, you know, she understands me and understands what I'm going through and has learned to navigate that in a way that is both helpful to me while also allowing me to exist in my headspace without fear of judgment and repercussions.
Yeah. And right. And lastly, most importantly, not taking it personal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, again, the contrast between ex-wife and current wife is ex-wife took everything personal. My irritability. Oh, you're always fucking, you know, fucking. And don't get me wrong. I was an asshole. And you hear my current wife will tell you, I'm still an asshole. So it wasn't 100% her fault. And I don't want to make it seem like it was 100% her fault. I take full responsibility for every shitty thing I did to her and my kids. Full responsibility. And that's back to taking onus on myself, right? I had to take control of myself. But
it's a process.
Right. But in a toxic situation, it's not, if you want your mental to change inside of a toxic situation, it's never going to.
Yeah. The pig can't get clean in the mud.
Right. Right. So as soon as I left that toxic, and again, equally responsible for the toxicity of that, you know, that relationship.
You were dumping shitty barrels in the lake just like she was.
Amen. And, you know, and we were mutually shitty to each other. So for her benefit and mine, right, you know, it was one of them amicable, you know, things. But yeah, this woman loves me so much to allow me to navigate my ebb and flows every day. And that's, you know, I never thought I was deserving. I never thought I warranted that type of love, and to find it so soon after leaving that situation. You know what I mean? Like, I'm saying what helped me.
Right.
Right. But understand, if you're in a toxic situation right now and you think she'll change or he'll change, guess what? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing, expecting a different result. It is what it is. They are who they show you they are.
It's in a way, it's easier to love yourself when you find someone who loves you unconditionally. Right. Because then you're like, well, if they love me, maybe I'm worth loving myself. You know, and if I can love myself and they love me, then it makes my ability to love them so much more significant.
Yeah, it's a huge circle. And like, you shouldn't do something, you know what I mean? Like, they'll tell you, don't change for someone else, right? There's no lasting effect. But change for you. Well, and that's one thing, like, man, I'm changing me because I don't particularly, like, I tried to kill myself, so I don't particularly like myself much, right? So how do you change that mindset, right? You know, I went from sitting on the couch every day of my life for damn near a whole year with the biggest struggle in my life is, should I put pants on today? You know what I mean? And drinking an absurd amount of alcohol. To, you know, having a suicide attempt and then saying, all right, if you're not going to kill yourself right now, tomorrow, you got to get your ass moved. And that was the deal I made with myself. You know, that was the heads and tails of the coin I flipped. When I was contemplating suicide, I was flipping a coin. You know what I mean? Heads, that's where I'm putting the bullet. Tails, I'm getting my ass in gear. And for
you, that, right? So that is a microcosm of the struggle with survivor's guilt. You're not worthy. Make me worthy. I'm going to end it because I'm not worthy and I don't like myself. Well, if you're not going to do that, then show Lieutenant Diaz that you were worthy to continue on.
Right.
And yep. And so that's like that whole allow the thoughts to happen and then accept them. The thoughts are happening regardless.
Right.
We just need to learn to accept them into our, what you call the new norm.
Yep. And last on this coping mechanism list is do something good for others, right? So I didn't look at this list back then, right? And say, oh, this is what I have to do. Think differently. Check. Fucking mindfulness. Check. You know, I didn't look at that thing. It was, I lost my purpose. I lost my direction. I lost my motivation. For all you non-commissioned officers out there, you understand what I'm saying. When you lose your purpose, you know what I mean? I lost a lot of things in a short amount of time. You know, my career ended, my marriage ended, my career of 22 years ended, marriage of 25 years ended. You know what I mean? Like, holy shit. And my whole adult life is tied to those two things. And, you know, what are you going to do now? You know? So, again, it took someone not knowing me from Adam to look at me and said, Hey bud, you need help. And I'm like, I'm good. Like, I've seen you three times this week and you've been fucking inebriated all three times. Oh, that's a coincidence.
Yeah. That's just fucking Tuesday, man. What the fuck?
That's a coincidence. And, but you know, it took someone to say, I don't think this is healthy. You know what I mean? Or they call you, what are you doing? Nothing. Oh, what are you going to do? Nothing. How about we go do something? Nah, I'm good. That involves putting pants on. You know
what I mean? That involves pants, sobriety, and putting down the controller.
Right? Yeah. I mean, right. So, but you know, it's the relentless. No one can make someone feel different about themselves other than themselves, right? I mean, I can give you all this positive affirmation and you're going to feel the way about yourself than you do, you know what I mean? And so it's about changing, altering, like this says, altering them. The thoughts are them deep down thoughts are going to be there.
Yep.
Them unconscious thoughts that come up when you smell a smell, see something that has nothing to do with this event or other events that happen, has absolutely nothing to do with it. But one little thing is the same as, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it'll take you right back.
Yep.
So there's no change in that.
And I think that's from our experience, what you're saying, that's what survivor's guilt is. It's how you feel about yourself in relation to something that happened to you.
Right.
And the only way you're going to quote unquote fix that or incorporate that into your new normal or whatever it is you just try to use those coping mechanisms you listed off. And maybe they apply to you. Maybe they don't. Maybe you got your own different ones, you know, because we're all wired a little bit differently.
Uh-huh.
You just fumble fuck your way through it until you figure it out. I mean, yeah. That's basically what we do. We fumble fuck our way through it on our own. We fumble fuck our way through it with our healthcare providers. And, you know, they're like, hey, throw this at the wall and see what sticks. And eventually, you know, you either can cope,
yep,
or you succumb.
Yep.
You know, and you got eventually the rubber's going to meet the road and one of those two things are going to happen. Hopefully, if you're listening to this right now and you're trying to decide whether you want to cope or succumb, there is light at the end of the coping tunnel.
Yeah.
There is no light at the end of the succumb tunnel.
Right.
So take that tunnel that's got the light. It may be fucking 40 miles down the goddamn tunnel, but it's there.
Yeah.
We can attest,
yeah,
that it's there.
And we can also attest that we both help others. We both are active in our communities, be it the veteran community or you know, things that we're passionate about, being a basketball coach for your son or things of that nature. What, like, you know, involvement, right? The more you're involved in things, the more responsibilities you seem to be handed, right? Or take on. And, you know, for people that are looking for purpose and direction and motivation and things of that nature, you want responsibilities. You know, like I needed responsibilities. I needed to be held accountable for something. You know what I mean? And that's what led me into all the different leadership roles I've played outside of the military. That's what that's what made it easy for me to go that route. Because I needed it. And man, since those times, since doing that, everything else has fell into place. And, you know, again, suicide is a permanent solution to whatever temporary problem you have. And again, we go back to survivor's guilt that I said, well, apparently I've been dealing with survivor's guilt for the last 18 years. It's still temporary. You know what I mean? It's still temporary. And I'll tell you what else is a coping mechanism. Like some of those thought processes that I had immediately following this event or, you know, subsequently after that, you know, the superiority complex that I talked about, thinking, hey, I could have changed this. I could have stopped this. I could have, you know, I was put into situations after that humbled me, that said, okay, maybe I'm not as shit hot as I thought I was. Maybe I can't fix everything. Maybe I can't, you know, and makes me look at this situation a little differently. And, you know, I don't know why I wasn't in that chow hall that day. I don't. I really don't.
But all you can do is live in a way that honors the LT,
yep,
but also values the life that you were allowed to continue on with.
Yeah, man. And again, my good friend, Sergeant Major Munoz down at the 20th Engineer Brigade, just retired, after a stellar career, Brigade Sergeant Major down there. And he brought up, Lieutenant Diaz in his retirement speech, because he was a young E6 in his platoon. So, I mean, that's what it matters. It's, you know, when we say never forget, you know, that's what we're talking about. And, you know, sometimes never forget means I can't forget.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're kind of, I don't want to say burdened, but you're given that responsibility.
Yeah,
you can't forget.
The memory of that individual is an honor to carry with you the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
The burden is the experience of their death.
Right. And yeah, it's, you know, but I'll tell you what, a lot of people close off and, they shut down and, you know, you hear the, many people, the World War II veterans never spoke about the war. Korean War veterans never spoke about the war. Vietnam veterans very rarely spoke about the war, and they held that shit in. And that was, the sign of the times. You know what I mean? That was, I'll tell you, it's so therapeutic for me to get it out, talk about it. Hey, this, you know, I'm the last person to worry about my masculinity, if somebody's going to think I'm weak or whatever the case may, you know, if telling my story, if telling, someone that's going through it, hey bro, or hey babe, you can get through it. Is it going to be easy? Fuck no. Are you going to want to quit? Fuck yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like being on a roads march, man. You know, you walk 12 miles 1 foot at a time.
Yep.
1 foot at a time. You're like, I don't need you to finish. I just need you to take another step. And that's, you know, when I did, my work for, Veteran Suicide Group Mission 22, being the state leader, in the state of Ohio. That's what I used to tell people, like, be the reason, right? Family members, loved ones, other veterans, you know, be the reason a veteran lives that final second, right? It takes 1 second to swallow pills, to slit your wrists, to not to be gory, right? But you know, the dance around the topic of suicide, the dance around these things, we're so far past that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it takes 1 second to step off a ledge, to put a gun to your head, all that thing. It takes 1 second. Be the reason that veteran lives that final second. And if you're the reason they live that final second, then continue to be the reason they live every second after that.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And I'll put a bow on this thing with, you know, again, a dear friend of mine saw me at my worst point, and she gave me that reason to survive that last second and to continue living, right? And then I met my wife, and, you know, she gives me a reason to live every day. So if you think at the last moment, you know, nobody will care if I die. People will care. I'll care. You'll care. If you need a sign not to kill yourself, here's your sign. If you want to come on this podcast and talk and get your story out there, do it. If you don't want to do it on air and you want to just, you know, talk to us and be like, hey man, I don't want to be on a podcast, but I just like to talk to somebody. We'll talk to you. You know, it ain't about, we're not about streams. We're not about, any of that. We're not making a dime off this podcast. So I mean, if you want to reach out, man, we're here. Again, we're not medical professionals, but we are professionals at dealing with post-traumatic stress, with depression, with anxiety, with survivor's guilt, and a slew of other things we're going to talk about as we go through these podcasts, and we're going to get our friends on and do the same. But
and if we can't, if we know of a resource that will help you, we will straight point you in that direction as well.
Oh yeah, most certainly. I mean, and you know, there's a notion out there, by talking about suicide, you're giving people ideas of suicide and things of that nature, and you know, it's one of these things, man. People are going to do exactly what they want to do, and if you want to do that, you're going to do that. We want to give you options, right? Because at the end, people think they don't have options. We want to give you options. We want to, you know, if you think you don't matter, you do. And, you know,
if nothing else, don't pull the trigger so that next week you can hear how dumb we are.
So, you know, if you're dealing with survivor's guilt, hey, keep battling. All right.
Keep being a survivor.
You know, we don't like to use the word suffer. I suffer from post-traumatic stress. I suffer from anxiety. I don't suffer from anything. I battle post-traumatic stress. I battle, you know, and that's a mindset you have to, you know, we're all warriors, right? We're veterans. We're warriors, right? So battle that shit. Continue to battle. We encourage your feedback and want to hear your stories. Hit us up, whiskeywillswounds.com. You'll find links to our social media and email. Remember, everyone deployed around the world, those still missing in action and prisoners of war, the homeless veterans in this country, and those veterans lost to suicide each year. Find a reason, not an excuse.
Thank you for listening. See you next time.